Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
So guess who's voting against the Friday night budget compromise?
Every dollar we spend, 41 cents of every dollar is borrowed money. How long could you live like that? My husband and I couldn't live more than a month like that.
All this would be done while we would preserve subsidies to oil companies and special interests, protect tax breaks for the wealthiest Americans, and for companies that ship jobs overseas. After all, why should General Electric pay any taxes?
New York City Democrat Gerald Nadler, Tea Party Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann of Minnesota, both planning to vote no on the deal. And you just heard in the news some of what's in it and not in it that upsets people on either side. Bachmann, for good measure, saying maybe a refusal to raise the debt ceiling and have the U.S. default on its treasuries might not be such a bad thing. Don't worry, she won't have a majority on that. Of course, it doesn't help that in 2006, a certain freshman senator from Illinois named Barack Obama voted against raising the debt ceiling.
He realizes now that raising the debt ceiling is so important to the health of this economy and the global economy that it is not a vote that even when you are protesting an administration's policies, you can play around with.
White House spokesman Jay Carney playing the youthful indiscretion card. But assuming the six-month deal agreed to Friday night and the short-term debt ceiling negotiation get through Congress, not assured, but likely, now comes the really big-ticket item, the decade-long plan to lower the federal deficit, reform the tax code, and afford the baby boomers as the population bubble gets onto Social Security and Medicare. The Republicans, as we've talked about, have started the negotiation with the Paul Ryan plan, privatizing Medicare, turning Medicaid into a block grant to the states rather than a federal guarantee of health insurance for the poor, and lowering the top tax rate by 10 more points. Tomorrow comes the Obama speech, early afternoon, that could include his own detailed plan. We will have a live chat and coverage during the speech on our politics website. It's afreecountry.org. Watch it with us. We thought that in advance of that, we would take some time this morning to explain the deficit a bit in plain English and plain math, with some politics thrown in too, but mostly economics. To help us with this is Robin Farzad from Bloomberg Businessweek. Hi, Robin. Welcome back to WNYC.
How are you? Wait, we're explaining the deficit. You didn't mention anything about that.
Oh, no. You thought we were going to talk baseball?
Oh, shoot. All right.
All right. To harken back to the Michelle Bachmann clip, first of all, are we borrowing to pay for 40% of the federal budget this year?
$1.6 trillion deficit, roughly, on a, you know, just under $4 trillion budget. That is true. I mean, right now, but that's a function of a couple of things. The economy is not strong enough, and with unemployment near 9%, you're not collecting the revenue, the tax receipts that you would to make that denominator bigger. And then as a function of that, maybe the percentage smaller. So, yes, there's a lot of ledger domain here, and she makes a very poignant and compelling soundbite.
As I crunch 1.6 trillion out of 3.6 trillion, that is a 44% borrowing rate to fund this year's operating budget. The late 90s was the last time the government was running surpluses. That was because the economy was humming along so much in the tech bubble and we had higher income tax rates.
That's right. That's right. I mean, tax rates have really been depressed ever since Bush came to office and got his wish of tax cuts across the board. And that was obviously extended by Obama just to get a kind of a stopgap, a two-year. And so there's two elements of this. There's the revenue side of it. That's a euphemism for tax cuts and tax increases. And there is the budgetary side of it, where you're wondering, gosh, can we cut things here and there to kind of make the spending numerator maybe smaller?
The government is not a business, so a surplus, a profit, is not the goal. But what kind of deficits do economists think are sustainable?
This has always been a huge question, and it goes back, harkens back to the time of Alexander Hamilton. Alexander Hamilton believed that a debt was a good thing. I mean, that you shouldn't just operate at break even. You should aim to endeavor to live maybe above your means a bit, because all other things being equal, the economy will grow. International capital markets will lend to you. Other countries will lend to you. And that's somewhat been vindicated for all the massive deficits that we're rolling over right now. And we have, what, $14.3 trillion and an estimated $19 trillion in 10 years. Bond yields are ridiculously low. The Chinese still lend to us. People still buy government bonds. So we're not being punished by bond vigilantes. Having said that, if there is going to be a game of chicken over the debt ceiling and you see interest rates creep up, that could really make debt payments go up even more.
And listeners, you can get in on this. You can ask a question if there's anything you always wanted to know about the deficit in plain English and plain math, but you had no one to ask. You now have Robin Farzad from Bloomberg Business Week. Or if you want to throw in your own little tidbit about this that you've accumulated along the way, your own wisdom and knowledge about debt and deficits, Robin may
also
fact
baseball,
check you.
Baseball and the Civil War. We're open to anything.
150 years ago today. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And they didn't even play with mitts back then. I've heard the debate, or to our webpage, by the way, WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show, or through social media, tweet at Brian Lehrer or at A Free Country, and you can find us on Facebook.com/.
Wait, may I give you one germane Civil War factoid?
Wait, Facebook, just to finish the plug, Facebook.com/Brian Lehrer, WNYC. What?
Amazing. I read this in a magazine recently that a widow who married a Civil War veteran in the 1920s when she was 18 and he was 81, she only passed away in 2003 and was still collecting a $70 a month VA pension from him fighting in 1862. So that's a three-century entitlement, and that's very germane to the entitlements debate we have in this budget battle.
What percentage of the federal deficit was that? Never mind. I've heard the debate between Democrats and Republicans that on one level is between spending 20% of GDP or 24% of GDP on the federal government. I think we've been at 20% many times in the past. We're about 24% now. It doesn't sound like such a big spread. Why is it such a political fault line?
Look, no soothsayer can tell you for sure, you know, in 5 years or even 3 years, what percentage of GDP this debt's going to be. There's so many moving parts from revenue coming in, whether we're going to be fighting three or four wars, whether the stock market booms and capital gains receipts sluice in. So I don't really put a lot of stock in that. The fault lines are here in that the Tea Party won a huge victory in the congressional beatdown. And when you have someone like Representative Ryan coming out and touching third rails of government, Medicare in this example, and talking about slashing Medicare, talking about really representing the Tea Party agenda and certain elements, and that you could simultaneously cut the top tax rate and cut spending, you're really forcing the administration's hand. They're kind of saying, well, we're putting political skin in the game, and now we're going to force you to come out and sacrifice some of your fiscal sacred cows.
What percentage of the federal budget this year is for debt service to pay back the past accumulated debt?
Well, we have national debt of $14.3 trillion, and I believe that that kind of matches economic output in this. I mean, that's a kind of a one-to-one ratio. That's pretty staggering. And when you come out and look at this debt increasing, both under the Ryan plan and the Obama plan, by 2016, you're about $14 trillion or $15 trillion. And then by 2021, that balloons to $16 trillion and $19 trillion. So there's still going to be deficit spending into the next decade, anywhere of $5 to $7 trillion.
When you say one-to-one, $14.3 trillion, that's the size of the accumulated federal debt, and also that's the size of the total American economy for this year, roughly?
Right, if I have to check the numbers on economic output this year. And that just gives you an idea of kind of, you know, you can't as a company, as an enterprise, operate at kind of revenue to debt a one-to-one ratio. I mean, there's a plus or minus there, but it shows you how big the debt has ballooned to.
Why can't you? I mean, Michelle Bachmann used a household analogy, and I don't know how legitimate or analogous that actually is. But if I'm going to use a household analogy, I could say the typical American family has a mortgage on a home that is more than their annual income, right? If somebody earns $50,000 a year, they're living in a more than $50,000 house with a more than $50,000 mortgage typically.
Correct. But the carrying cost of that mortgage is being amortized over, what, 20, 30 years? We're talking about operating expenses. I mean, the government is looking to raise the debt ceiling so it could just pay the bills to keep the lights on into the end of the year. And I don't know of any sustainable household that is just, you know, looking for increases on the credit card limit just to be able to pay cable and utilities every month. I mean, that's the more fitting analogy.
Now, Congressman Ryan says his plan reduces the deficit by $6 trillion. Does that mean he claims it lowers the total debt by that much? $14 trillion is going to go down to $8 trillion? No, right?
No, it doesn't. It doesn't, absolutely. Because, you know, he's trying to, I don't want to say have his cake and eat it too, but it's interesting in that it's cutting the top tax rate from 35% to 25%. So already, if we've had lower than average historical, you know, top marginal tax rates over the past decade, you're going to get even ostensibly less revenue. We don't know if the, you know, the Reagan supply side experiment is going to work over the next decade or so, but he is banking on that working. So can you cut potential revenue coming in and cut spending at the same time and ultimately produce a smaller gap? He claims that he can, to the tune of $2 trillion less in deficit spending than Obama's plan.
Does the Ryan plan produce an annual surplus or a balanced budget by the end of the 10 years?
No, it produces deficit spending in the next decade. I mean, we still have a $16 trillion debt under Ryan by 2021 versus $19 trillion. These people can fudge the numbers by saying then that's just a multiple of GDP. So there are a lot of moving parts. There are a lot of inputs that you put in this thing, and the devil is certainly in the details.
Robin Farzad from Bloomberg Businessweek helping us understand the basic economics of the federal debt, the federal deficit, percentage of GDP, that is the federal operating budget, and why that matters, percentage of the federal operating budget this year that is borrowed and why that matters. And if you have any questions or comments along the line, and this is not the segment, folks, for you to make your sharpest policy arguments to say why Ryan's right or wrong or Obama's going to be right or wrong. We're trying to really get the numbers on the table for some basic baseline understanding before we really go headlong into this debate with the president's speech tomorrow expected. So let's stick to that kind of thing. But 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And Kenneth in Washington Heights, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Yes. What would happen if China suddenly decides that we're no longer a good credit risk and they stop loaning to us? What would happen then?
The bond market reacts and interest rates shoot up. And you can, as the government, go out and issue 10-year debt at 3.3%. Maybe it's going to creep up to 4%, 5%. This is the huge fear. And everybody in D.C., Republican, Democrat, Tea Party, Independent, is putting their hands over their eyes and hoping that this, you know, specter, this boogeyman goes away, because it could be so catastrophic.
Well, is it really a boogeyman with any realistic prospect of, you know, becoming real? Because what I seem to always hear is that China has such a stake in the U.S. economy remaining strong, because China exports goods to here, among other reasons, that it has no interest in calling back all that debt and crashing the American economy.
True, but if it can't fund, if it doesn't have the surpluses, the excess manufacturing revenue coming in continuously to be able to funnel that money overseas, then that really calls into question. If there's an economic crisis in China and it has to keep the money at home, if China faces rioting in the countryside, if that, you know, breakneck GDP pace of 8 to 10% falls, that money certainly is, you can't afford to send it abroad and keep interest rates here down.
Joan in Clifton, you're on WNYC. Hello, Joan.
Hi. I have a quick question here. The Social Security lockbox, which is not to be touched, has been funding wars, the invasion of Iraq, Afghanistan, we're Libya now, all these oil-rich countries. Do we know over the years how much money has come out of Social Security to fund this, and why do we continue doing it?
I'm so glad you raised this question, because I think, Robin, that one of the things that most people don't understand is that Social Security, at least up until now, rather than costing the taxpayers money, has actually been running a surplus, I think, every year since Social Security came into existence. and is actually helping to fund, is lending money to the federal government for annual operating. Isn't that true?
True, but that recourse is back to the economy as millions of baby boomers qualify for Social Security. And let's talk about Medicare as well over the next 10, 20 years. And that's why it's so murky to kind of look into that crystal ball and say, we can count on Social Security surpluses. There are people out there that are saying the whole system is going to be broke by 2030. So don't count on it as kind of being a nest egg out there. It's going to be a huge drain if certain cuts aren't made, i.e. lifting the age for Social Security.
Or the cap on Social Security taxes at what income. But that's something to really be angry at the federal government for over many years, isn't it? That rather than have the so-called lockbox where the Social Security surplus got put away for future Social Security needs, that money was siphoned off into that year's operating expenses. So what should be a Social Security surplus that we could draw on in the future as the baby boomers age isn't actually there. Is that accurate?
In corporate America, that would be construed as accounting fraud. But Washington goes by its own generally accepted accounting principles.
You mentioned Medicare. Obviously, Medicare, Medicaid, big things. These are the main things that the Ryan plan deals with. What percentage of the federal budget is for Medicare? Do you know?
Well, over the next decade, if you have, you know, Medicare at $389 billion cut out of the Ryan budget and $735 billion less to Medicaid, you're talking, I mean, on a static level, every year you look at the budget, it is, you know, roughly this stuff adds up to 24-30%. Medicaid less than Medicare, but Medicare is a huge entitlement, and especially because you have the asymmetry of the government coming out there and effectively making a blank check type entitlement. And on the other side of that is the private sector, where prices have been going up way above the cost of inflation. So the deficits within just that slice balloon every year. And so he is at least making an effort to try to get some sort of cut sustainably out of Medicare as a block grant.
What percentage of the federal government is for Medicaid?
Medicaid is less than that. I mean, $735 billion of the federal government goes to Medicaid. You have states matching as well. And so that is closer to the low single digit, the low double digits, as opposed to Medicare, which gets north of 20%.
And what percentage is for the military, which, by the way, Ryan intends to increase rather than cut?
Similarly, between 20 and 25%. And that is something that is kind of a sacred cow within Ryan's budget proposal. No Social Security, no defense cuts. And that's something that really has retained a third rail status.
Let's take another call. Here is Sheila on Staten Island. You're on WNYC. Hello.
Yes, hello. You know, I think that we have just too many entitlements in this country. And does China have entitlements?
Does China have Social Security?
No. China doesn't have anywhere near this. And that's an economy that's still evolving. It's more akin to our progressive era and maybe where we were in the early 20th century. China's certainly going to need to have a national system of insurance, of old age insurance, especially with demography there being completely different than it is in the United States.
Do they have Medicaid, health care for the poor?
No. No. All of this stuff is essentially they're making it up as they go along. And you know, it's in a kind of a Darwinian, Dickensian sense, the wealthy there get access to financial services products and insurance, and others don't.
So, Sheila, when you say we have too many entitlements, do you want to have a Social Security program, a Medicare program, a Medicaid program, or how are you looking at it?
Well, I'm looking at it as that we I think it's just like a panacea. We're living in a panacea where we have so many entitlements. And, you know, maybe China's successful because they don't have that.
China is a poor country, though. Let's not, I mean, you don't want to, you know, China's economy is still a fraction of the size of ours. And the per capita income, I mean, you don't want to be, you know, a Chinese person who's earning a couple of bucks at a factory might be upwardly mobile in a Chinese sense, but certainly not in any sort of developed Western sense.
All right, Sheila, thank you. We're almost out of time. I think we've explained a lot of the underlying concepts. I want to ask you one more thing, because conservatives in the media like to say that cutting income tax rates actually produces more revenue for the government because it grows the private economy so much. But the Ryan plan does not appear to make that claim. does not appear to claim that its lower tax rates will produce more revenue than the current rates, does it?
No, it doesn't. But implicitly, by putting in the top tax rate cut is, you know, from 35 to 25%, it's saying that, look, you can have this broad rubric of cutting out-of-control spending and have tax cuts at the same time. You've had multiple bipartisan commissions on the Hill that are saying that's just not possible. Not only can you not cut tax rates, but you're going to have to vastly increase them among certain segments and pull back entitlements and increase ages for Social Security. And other tough things, by the way, that nobody wants to touch, such as the housing deduction, the mortgage deduction, which is costing the government trillions over several years.
All right. So, again, tomorrow, President Obama unveils his plan. We will see where he goes with it. The speech doesn't have an exact start time yet, but we are told it is early afternoon. You can join me live during it for a live online chat. We can sort of watch the speech together on our politics website, itsafreecountry.org, and chat at the same time. So stay tuned for the exact start time. We'll be telling you that today if we know it, or tomorrow morning. And we want to thank Robin Farzad from Bloomberg Business Week for doing such a good backgrounder for us. Next time we can get together and talk about maybe World War I and the NBA.
What do you think? Thank you, Brian. It's a pleasure.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, why France is suddenly a war hawk nation, even as it panders to its anti-Muslim right. And then we will have a call in, and get ready for this, folks, especially if you're immigrants from anywhere. Anyone who follows non-English language news media from anywhere in the world, what headlines are you reading or hearing that the rest of us may not be? We'll do that call in about 15 minutes. Stay with us.